From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Mr. Pickwick, sir, on the carriage, room for all, up on top, gentlemen. Is there not space enough inside the carriage? I wouldn't hear of it, sir. Only way to see the world, this only way.
Indeed, how would we see the world without stories like the Pickwick Papers of Charles Dickens? His skill with the rough-and-tumble language of English daily life turned the social issues of his day into subjects for everyday conversation. In the world of diplomacy, however, it was a different language the people wanted, and perhaps it still is.
People do still perceive it as a language associated with refinement, with cuisine, with art, with philosophy, with literature. And there's something about French culture that's very charismatic, and people still want to participate in that and be part of that.
In the grand halls and in the stalls, we'll look at language in this hour as Charles Dickens visits America and a bilingual Canadian looks at the story of French. But for scholars of language, it isn't storytelling that's most important, but the very fact that we have language at all.
People feel very strongly about the uniqueness of human beings compared to all other animals. So for a long time, people thought language was just this completely discrete, monolithic thing, and you either had it or you didn't.
Is language, in fact, the very thing that makes us who we are? Science can happily tell us that we share a common ancestor with apes, but when it comes to language, well, there's been a lot of resistance to the notion that it's not ours alone. For linguist Christine Keneally, that is the most interesting question of study, one she's followed meticulously in her book, The First Word. Steve Paulson asked her why the study of the evolution of language was not studied for such a long time.
It was a taboo subject because in 1886, it was literally a taboo subject. The French Linguistic Society banned language evolution study, and they did this for a very good reason, that language doesn't fossilize. It's basically air, and it disappears as soon as you talk it. And, you know, there are sort of ways of looking at the body and seeing if a body might be able to produce language, but they're all very indirect. So this ban was laid down, and it sort of transmuted into this kind of embarrassment about language evolution, which lasted up until the last 20 years or so.
So for about a century or so, basically, no one studied the evolution of language.
Almost no one studied it, and the people that have studied it in the last maybe 30, 40 years have been these really smart, interesting mavericks who kind of worked on it in isolation. And then, you know, just very recently, people like them and others have been coming together and getting a real dialogue going.
Now, this whole question is so fascinating because language poses some very basic questions. I mean, is language what makes us unique? Is it the defining
exactly.
trait of human beings?
Exactly.
And is language basically the same as thinking? I mean, can you think outside of language, or are they more or less one and the same thing?
Yeah, you can. You can think outside of language. And the question of human uniqueness and is language what makes us unique is incredible. And I think it's also why the subject was avoided for so long, because people feel very strongly about the uniqueness of human beings compared to all other animals. So for a long time, people thought language was just this completely discrete, monolithic thing, and you either had it or you didn't. And so humans had it, no other animal did it. And now they think of it more as this whole complicated suite of abilities and predispositions, so that many of them are old, some of them are new, and we share some of them with other animals. So as a whole, language is unique and it makes us unique. But if you start to break it down, you actually find it's this patchwork of very common traits among animals, or at least a lot of it is.
Mm-hmm. Now, for decades, there's been one person who's really dominated the whole field of linguistics, and that's Noam Chomsky. Can you give me some sense of how Chomsky's theories have laid down the groundwork for how this whole field is studied?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Chomsky is very interested in the structure of language, in just syntax, and that's shaped linguistics for, you know, 50 years now. He made some fascinating and interesting statements way back with the publication of his first books about how language is this very complicated thing. People up to that point thought perhaps language actually wasn't necessarily that complicated. So Chomsky reminded everyone that language is actually really complicated, and that the fact that children can acquire language in the short amount of time that they do is a really amazing feat. And that sort of set the tone for linguistics for many decades. How is it that children can acquire this incredibly complicated structure, can become completely adept in grammar in, you know, a fairly short amount of time, can acquire up to 60,000 words. And Chomsky himself was not especially interested in language evolution. And you could even say he was rather pointedly disinterested. He thought that because language was this incredibly complicated thing, it was too hard perhaps to find out how it evolved, and also that it must have happened all at once. When people thought about language as this rather singular human trait, it sort of led you to imagine that first we didn't have language and then we did have language.
So his theory is that somehow our brains are wired to acquire language.
That's right. That's right. And that understanding has become a lot more sophisticated over the years. But the initial idea was that almost that there was a part of the brain that was specifically for language and language alone. And that shaped the thought of generations and generations of scholars all over the world. And now we realize that's just not true, that there is no language-specific part of the brain, that language is processed all over the brain. And there's no part of the brain that even appears to, as far as we know right now, just do language processing or language production. So that kind of needed to be broken down, and neuroscience really needed to be able to show us that that wasn't the case.
Is it fair to say that language helped human beings become so successful from an evolutionary standpoint?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we had to develop it to some certain extent in the first place, but now it's just this enormous spiral where language and culture interact with our biology, and it's inseparable from us now. And you know, if language was suddenly somehow taken away from human beings, I think there's a real question mark as to whether we would survive at all. Language is essential to our biology now.
And yet not every biologist has thought that way. I mean, Stephen Jay Gould famously said that language was just a byproduct of evolution. It really had no intrinsic value of its own.
Right. He did. And it was between Stephen Jay Gould and Noam Chomsky who felt that language probably wasn't an adaptation or a very useful one, that was why people ignored it for such a long time. And then, you know, various scientists came along, including Steven Pinker, who said, it just simply cannot be. Language is so complicated. There is such design in language that the hand of evolution must be at work here. And, you know, it was actually a paper that Pinker published that got everyone very excited about the possibility of looking at language as an adaptation since then.
So how did Steven Pinker change this debate about the evolution of language?
Well, in 1990, a graduate student called Paul Bloom, who is now a very well-known linguist at Yale, approached Steve Pinker and suggested that they look at language evolution together. He'd been along to a talk by someone who'd said that language hadn't evolved, just the stock line, and he was inspired to challenge that. And so they got together and they wrote this paper and they published it in this journal where a lot of people participate. So a paper is published and about, I think there were 30 commenters who wrote about it. And, you know, they really hit a nerve. Some people were extremely excited. And, you know, this can be a bit unusual in academia when people sort of feel liberated by someone's scholarly paper. And other people were quite angry about it and thought that it was ridiculous because they still felt it was, you know, the sort of Chomsky idea that the language didn't evolve. So when he published that paper, that really kicked it off. And in a sense, I think it gave people permission to look at the subject.
But yet in defense of Chomsky, it still is very hard to understand how language, which is so incredibly complex, how it could evolve incrementally over hundreds of thousands of years, maybe millions of years. I mean, how could that happen?
Yeah. Well, I think when you actually start to look at these components, these ancient components that are shared by other animals, you start to get a really good idea. So gesture, for example, gesture itself has also been sort of dismissed in linguistics for a long, long time. And people are starting to realize now it's much more closely related both to language and also to thought than we ever realized. But what we've discovered in the last 20 or so years is that apes gesture in these very meaningful ways and in ways that humans would recognize instantly. There was a very recent experiment published just a few months ago about orangutans, and the orangutans were placed in front of a table with food and the researchers were behind the table. And the orangutans couldn't reach the food. They had to gesture to the researchers to let them know that they wanted the food. So when the orangutans gestured, sometimes the researchers pretended they didn't understand what they were saying at all. And in exactly the way that a human might do it, what the orangutan then did was completely change their gesture to try to get the human to understand. If the human pretended that they kind of understood, but they weren't quite sure what the orangutan wanted, what the orangutan did was stick with the same gesture, but just do it a whole lot more emphatically. And I think people find that very familiar. And when you realize that, you know, these animals with whom we shared a common ancestor 14 million years ago, if that common ancestor had that ability to communicate and have meaning, then, you know, you're not that far a step from language. And you're certainly not going from a state of no language to language.
So what would you say are the biggest mysteries left in trying to figure this whole thing out, how language evolved?
I think what we would love to know is just to pinpoint a little bit more clearly when speech began. That's something that we're really not sure about. One of the ways that people look at that is they look at Neanderthals, who are quite closely related to human beings and the remains of Neanderthals. And the argument is that Neanderthals may have had complicated gesture, but they couldn't make speech as complicatedly as we do. Our last common ancestor with Neanderthals was around 500,000 years ago. So there's this idea that speech started to originate between now and then. And of course, we were all in Africa until about 60,000 years ago, and then the human race spread out across the world. And it seems to be the case that maybe that last mutation on the FOXP2 gene happened just before that. So it would be great to pin that down a bit more and find out if those two things really are connected.
Do you think some of these mysteries will ever be resolved?
I do. I think it's so exciting. I think the last 20 years has set this really important base level of defining where we need to look. And I think even fossils are going to be found that will speak to this problem. You know, the fossils are very rare and large fossils are very hard to come across. But I think apart from all this great work on the brain and language, that we're even going to find fossils which will suggest to us when it began.
Well, this is a fascinating subject. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Christine Keneally is the author of The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. She talked with Steve Paulson.
Who are these people who have all this power? Power to make great, significant change in the lives of people who have nothing. And all they do is get fat and feed each other and maintain their power and the status quo. That's awful.
Who are they? They're the ones who drove Charles Dickens to write his enormously popular stories. Mr. Dickens visits America later this hour. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, and this is PRI, Public Radio International. Stephen Paulus has earned an international reputation, writing music for all kinds of performers, but he's best known for his choral output. That gives him a unique perspective on language, because he has to look beyond the words to the sounds behind them. A few years ago, Stephen Paulus stopped into our studios just after putting 6 poems to music for the Festival Choir of Madison. I was curious about that business of reshaping language to make it musical, and I asked him whether, for him, the music starts in a particular phrase in the poem.
It can happen a couple of ways. There may be one phrase that's more musical than others, or if you've hit a gold mine, the whole poem seems musical from the get-go. Like you'll see a word and you'll think, oh, I can open quietly with that, and the poem gets a little more active, and you think, and this will give me a place to grow musically. The key thing, a good friend of mine whom I've worked with a lot, Michael Dennis Brown, on operas, song cycles, choral pieces, teaches creative writing at the University of Minnesota, and he has said that the poet finds a structure in the poem. You have to have structure and form when you're creating something. And then he goes on to say, because he gives this talk on music and poetry, and he says, the composer finds yet another form when pairing the poem with the pitches that make up a musical piece. And often that form is different, at least slightly, from the original poem, because when we find phrases that we like, we'll say, oh, I want to repeat that, and I want to use bigger chords right each time. Well, you've changed the poem a little bit, but you've made a new form that people want to hear because it's a musical form.
Bringing the two things together is what you do, but they do start out, don't they, as separate languages? I mean, music is a language that speaks all by itself. Music does not require words to communicate.
No, but one of the magical things about pairing the words and the music is that I think it really makes for more power, more drama, more emotive and passionate capabilities when you pair the two, because the words already have a certain meaning. A poem by itself, especially when you hear it read by a poet who has a dramatic voice and knows where he or she wants to place pauses and enunciates in a certain way, and that's a performance, you know, if you go to hear a poetry reading, of course. When you pair those words that already have meaning by themselves with different harmonies and melodies that, like you say, can convey a meaning, if it's just oboe and a string orchestra, you can convey a wonderful meaning of melancholy or cheerfulness or sprightliness just with that. If somehow you have words that have been paired with pitches, I think it gives them a heightened sense of importance and drama and passion, if you want to go that route. Mm-hmm. So it makes them even more important. In a way, you're kind of wrecking the poem by making it fit into a different mold, but you're also making a new form that says this poem is not only good, it's fabulous because it can be paired with sounds that mean things to us as an audience.
Maybe you can demonstrate a little bit. The first one that you did for the festival choir was Grass by Dave Etter. Was there a particular phrase in this one? Do you remember the composition of this piece?
I do, and one thing I wanted to say about it is I ended up selecting this as the opening piece of the Prairie Songs. There's so many things that go into actually creating the musical composition, but I don't want it to seem overly complicated. So if I just start from some point here, I can say I wanted the piece to start much as the prairie does, whether it's on a morning or a summer day or whatever. It's big, it's wide, and it's expansive, but it's also very subtle, and it doesn't leap out at you sometimes. It just sort of creeps up on you, and it's there. So what I wanted to do was give the idea that there's space in the prairie. Mm-hmm. So the very thing I do is start with a fourth. It's just two parts, tenors and basses, and they sing, "The spring grass is growing." Is that a great line? I don't know. But if you think about it in the context of the prairie, it means something is happening. But I don't want to give away the whole nine yards from the beginning and make a big statement out of "the spring grass is growing." Let's, you know, do like that. It's not that kind of a thing. The spring grass is growing. It happens like one micromillimeter at a time. So it starts out just with the tenors and basses doing "the spring grass is growing." And it's like this. What happens there is that you also look, when I was reading this line, you look not only at the idea, the spring grass is growing, but you also look at words that have certain vowels. The spring. Spring is a little bit difficult word to say because there's so many sounds in it, but you see where this phrase is headed. The spring grass is growing, and the O sound is a nice one to make. So instead of just, in the other parts I played, each note has, or each word or each syllable has one note. The spring grass is, but you get to the word growing, and as a what we call tone painting or word painting.
Yeah, that O really wants to grow,
doesn't
it? The
O wants to grow, so let it grow musically. So we do growing. Right. Then I reiterate it, and it's sort of like when you can find a good thing in a text, like this word growing, you think, well, I want the piece to grow just the same way that the spring grass is growing.
Now, thinking of this same poem still later, there are some more complicated phrases where maybe the language of the poet restricts you a little bit.
It restricts you or demands, if we were to treat the whole poem like that, like what I just did on the word growing, you'd be saying that all the words are of equal interest in terms of their sound. Growing is interesting because of the O sound and what it means, growing.
And so, also, of course, the fact that you're beginning a six-song cycle here and you want to get it well planted.
Right, so there are times where you actually, where the poet says, you know, the gatherings of laughing men, for instance, and I just have to move it along. I can play that if you like.
Sure.
Let's see.
You can hear that, the gatherings of laughing men.
Exactly. Yeah. And they get to a high point because I'm trying to whip the music up to the point where we say, oh, something, if the men are laughing, it's probably billowing in sound. So we get them up to this. Other things that you think about when you're setting text to music is where the voices are going to be sitting when they sing. In this case, the sopranos are singing a high G, so it's got to be pretty loud because they're going to make a loud sound up there. The tenors are high, the basses are high, even the altos are pretty high. So that's the gatherings of laughing men is making much more of a statement than this growing, which is very quiet in the beginning.
I mean, you started this in the spring, you're ending it in the winter. That certainly makes a kind of chronological sense. Does it also musically develop that way?
Actually, what you're talking about was just, it was a desire. Oftentimes, when you write a piece of music, you operate on several levels at the same time. One is the obvious one we've been talking about, which is to represent the text. Another was the idea of capturing prairie somehow. And sort of a third one was simply to progress through seasons so that, you know, the prairie does that, so why shouldn't we do that if we're listening to something about the prairie? And it sort of ends up there with one capstone being this business about the old church, or our old church, which I felt was like, it was a place I wanted to end up because of the importance of the church in prairie life and in small town life. And that particular poem and setting has a feel to it, as far as I'm concerned, almost like coming home or coming back to your roots. And it's very, has a nostalgic quality that I also talked about wanting to put into this set.
The Old Church, the last of these pieces, it has a very clear image to it.
Mm-hmm.
The poetry, of course, creates that image. It's an old, weather-beaten church. It's out in the middle of the prairie. It's the wind blowing around it. It stands alone. There's no one nearby. That seems to demand certain things of you as a composer. Not only are you bringing people home, but you have to work in the what you would hear in a church. Maybe it offers you all sorts of opportunity.
Well, it does. And I'm glad you mentioned, you know, what you have to or might happen to hear in a church, because I decided this is not really a hymn, but it has qualities almost of a hymn, which I wanted to get across.
The old church leans nearby a well-worn road upon a hill that has no grass or tree. It's not, you know, actually this strikes me as a poem that may be better sung than read.
Oh, really?
Maybe by the time you get it out, I don't know.
Okay.
The winds from off the prairie now unload the dust they bring around it fitfully. Was there a phrase in this one that you began with?
This is one of those things where I think I just sat down, and sometimes the way I compose is sometimes just to read something, I go, oh, okay, this seems like it ought to be these sounds. And I think I literally sat down and started horsing around with some chords and came up with a phrase like this that opens the thing. The old church leans nearby a well-worn road. There's a little bit of resignation in that. Leans nearby a well-worn road. And the wonderful symbolism in this poem is it's not just about a little church. It's about a church that's seen families grow old and tragedy come in to the family and joyous occasions and the nostalgia that goes with, you know, watching that son or daughter grow up and move on to a career or get married or move out or whatever. And I just sort of sat down and I came up with these harmonies that work for it.
Returning to the altar.
Stephen Paulus wrote the Prairie Songs for the Festival Choir of Madison under the direction of Eric Tarnell. When I was in high school, the most common foreign language to take was French. Maybe because if any of us thought of going anywhere, Paris seemed like a good place to go. These days, I think it's more likely to be Chinese or Japanese if you're thinking about world travel, or Spanish because it's so prevalent in the U.S. But maybe we weren't so crazy, those of us who still find bonjour more appealing than ni hao. Julie Barlow and Jean-Benoit Nadeau are Canadians who had to learn French to speak to each other. And that led to an impassioned interest in the language. Anne Strainchamps was curious about that passion.
You and your partner have made a very thorough study of the history of the French language. What got you interested in the subject?
I mean, it was sort of an offshoot of our previous book, which was called 60 Million Frenchmen Can't Be Wrong, which was a study, a sort of global study of the French and why they think the way they do and organize themselves. And we had been sent to write 60 Million Frenchmen Can't Be Wrong originally by an American foundation who wanted us to explore why the French were resisting globalization. And one of the things we realized while we were there was, first of all, that the French weren't resisting globalization at all. And
there goes
secondly,
your book.
Yeah, there goes the idea for the fellowship. We turned it around, you know, and decided just to study the French and why the perceptions were the American media had the perceptions they did. And that's sort of the basis behind the book on the French. But we realized while we were there that French really was a global language. And we decided, you know, that's the story we really want to tell. You know, how did French get where it is? How did it export itself? How did it become so influential? And the fact that it really is to this day still an incredibly influential language, in spite of what a lot of people think and in spite of what the French themselves tend to think, which was interesting.
At one time, French was the language that native English speakers loved the most. I mean, people fell in love with French. And for a long time, French was the language of the high culture. It was the language of art and philosophy and diplomacy. It sort of ruled the world once, I guess, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely ruled the world. It ruled the world, I mean, specifically in the beginning in the 18th century with the salon culture in France and on into the 19th century. And it's funny because when we were researching for our book, we were asking people who are a little down on French these days, particularly in the United States, the teachers who are trying to promote French and are sort of facing the onslaught of Spanish and now Chinese. And we were asking them about the things, you know, why did you want to learn French? What did you want to learn? What attracted you to the language? And a lot of the reasons that people learn French are still those same reasons. People do still perceive it as a language of associated with refinement, with cuisine, with art, with philosophy, with literature. And people still want, there's something about French culture that's very charismatic, and people still want to participate in that and be part of that. Another thing that's sort of sprung up over, particularly over the last decades, is that French has come to represent a bit of a different worldview. And I think that the French and Quebecers in particular are more and more aware of this and more using this sort of to promote French.
What's the different worldview?
With the rise of the Francophonie, the organization that's a bit like the Commonwealth, but French-speaking countries. I mean, French is a very political language, and it's become associated with, in its history, of course, the ideals of the French Revolution. And with a lot of international humanitarian associations that are based in Geneva, French still is, ironically, you know, associated with being a passionate language, of one language of culture, a language of love, you know, still, but also with ideas of liberty, other ideas of human rights, you know, and things like that. So there are these two things going on that are still really attracting people to French, I think.
So in terms of the politics of the French language, is French seen also as, if one embraces French, is one embracing the antithesis of America's cultural hegemony?
Yeah, to a certain extent, I think that that's true and more true. I mean, one problem with the French themselves is that, I mean, there's a huge world of French speakers out there. 200 million people speak French on the planet. It's far from being the world's, you know, most spoken language. I think it's eighth or ninth now. But it's still a huge body of speakers out there. And the French have kept that at arm's length for a long time, partly because of the aftermath of the colonial misadventures. You know, the decolonization was tough on the French, and they don't want to be associated with another thing that looks like colonialism all over again. So they've kept all the ex-colonies at arm's length. And of course, a lot of the ex-colonies, most of the ex-colonies, use French now, and it's still the language of education, you know, in West Africa.
Well, one of the things that you write about, one of the things that really sets French apart as a language is in part the attitude the French have toward it. They are really remarkably passionate about their language.
They are. And, I mean, there's a number of historical reasons that that has sort of become the case. French was the first language in 1539. It became the language of state. It was the first language to become the language of a state. And that's remained until this day. It's a hard thing for a lot of English speakers to understand. The other thing, of course, is the creation of the French Academy in 1635 and the idea of a body ruling over a language, again, is another hard idea for a lot of Anglophones to sort of get their head around.
What exactly is the French Academy, and is it still going?
Yeah, the French Academy is still going. A lot of people think it's the only language academy in the world. It's so well known, you know. The French Academy was created, not many people know this, to actually, all it was created to do was to write a dictionary. And it's done a terrible job of that, and it's made the dictionaries that are never used, and it's never really been very efficient in that manner. The main importance of the French Academy today is its symbolic power as a place where the French language is controlled. And it's not, actually. I mean, the French Academy doesn't pass laws. It has no legal power whatsoever over the language. It sort of rubber stamps decisions that are made by another body. But it's the symbolic power of the French Academy to the French as a place where their language is, the norm of the language is maintained.
So what sorts of things does the French Academy weigh in on?
Well, there have been a number of language reform. I mean, well, they'll be asked these days whether a certain vocabulary change. Well, let me step back a little bit. There's this thing called the Délégation de la Langue, Comité Linguistique, linguistic committees that function in France, and it's part of the government. And they are volunteers who keep an eye on what sort of foreign languages are creeping into business. I mean, it's all about industry. And they will suggest new terms. In fact, they call Quebec every day to get ideas, because Quebec is very good at inventing new terms to replace English words that float into the language.
For example,
email. It's a famous example. The French were trying to find a French word for email, and they came up with mail, which was sort of an acronym. It didn't really work very well. And Quebecers came up with courriel, which is a mix of electronic, and courrier, mail. And it's very good. It works, and it's very cute. Quebecers later came up with a fantastic expression called pourriel, which is for junk, for spam, for junk mail, which is a mixture of pourri, rotten, and electronic mail.
Oh, that's
so, you know, it's this kind of thing. The French called Quebecers up almost every day to find things like that. But the Academy, the French Academy has a sort of, you know what it is? It's a kind of museum where people feel the French's language is being taken care of. It's got a lot of symbolic power. It doesn't actually do much.
So the French really treat their language, they have a kind of curatorial attitude toward
yes,
it. They treat their language as a work of art, which,
yep.
I mean, we don't do that at all in the U.S., at least. You know,
yeah.
New words enter English all the time, and
yeah.
the language is constantly morphing and changing, and some people
yeah.
feel, you know, being bastardized, but that's the nature of English. It's such a melting
yeah.
pot, really.
Yeah.
But French is not like that.
Well, the interesting thing is that there's a difference between what really happens in French and this symbolic idea that the French language has a norm. Now, this is all this very powerful idea that the French is indeed like there's a curator working on French. This, of course, goes back to the purism and that arose in the creation of the French Academy in the 17th century. And this is a theme that's remained in French culture and among all Francophones ever since. The reality, of course, is that French is changing all the time. One of the things we discovered, I mean, there's a lot of people perceive or portray English as a much more flexible language that invites a lot more vocabulary in. That's not really true. French probably does as much as English. What the French do is that they separate the terminology and vocabulary, everything that's scientific and technical, into separate dictionaries where that language doesn't appear in the mainstream dictionaries, the Larousse dictionary, for example. And it looks like there's less words in French, but there aren't actually.
What do you see as the future of French?
Well, I don't think that after so many centuries of being an influential, important international language and with the sort of clout that French has developed, I don't think it's going to disappear as an international language anytime soon. I see that the Chinese are learning the lessons of the French and starting to, you know, export teachers and work on various ways to export the language and the culture of China. And, you know, that sort of thing will perhaps eventually displace French. But it's hard to predict, you know. There's a lot of cultural exchange going on between Francophone countries that don't have anything to do with France now. Exchanges between, say, Quebec and Morocco. I know that Morocco wanted to develop, for instance, an MBA program in French, and so they took the idea from the University of Sherbrooke in Montreal. You know, there's a lot of this sort of exchange going on, which is creating a kind of momentum of its own. And it's growing. I mean, internet and easy communication between countries is working in favor of French the way it's working in favor of English. Not to the same extent, but we were surprised in our travels to see, you know, relationships being struck up between Senegal and Quebec or a maritime province and another country in West Africa. Mm. This stuff's going on everywhere, and French still is being used in international institutions less than it was, you know, a century ago, but it's a language that still has quite a bit of clout.
Julie Barlow is the author with her partner Jean-Benoît Nadeau of The Story of French. She talked with Anne Strangehams. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Dr. Jim Ridge thinks about Charles Dickens as a great social reformer masquerading as a storyteller. That's what drove him to work with his friend Jim DeVita to bring Dickens back for modern audiences to enjoy. After I had a chance to see their Dickens in America, I wanted to know more about the premise.
What if it's a public reading, but what if it's his last night? So here's this thing then that he fed off of. He loved being in front of his public, adored being able to perform. So this thing that fed his spirit, what if just hours ago he's decided that he can't do it anymore? So then that one performance becomes huge. It has huge ramifications for him.
So where do you start? What's the first scene? It's from Pickwick Papers?
The first scene is from, right, the Pickwick Papers, and we began with that one simply because we took this scene where Pickwick and his traveling companions meet.
Well, it has some opportunities for you as well, because it's an opportunity to leap into this with
right.
several voices.
Right, and that's why we picked it. He meets Jingles, and the four of them are then on top of this carriage rolling through the country, and Jingles just starts telling these outrageous stories, and the four companions become just enamored of this guy who seems to have traveled the world all over. And there was a chance automatically to have four or five voices right away. You know, you hit the audience, and again, the audience quickly catches on, or else they're lost for the entire night, that this is about one person presenting many voices, and the onus is really on the audience to engage their imagination if they're going to stay up with the evening, which is the best of theater in my mind, because then the audience can't sit back and sort of check themselves out of the equation of the evening. They have to be actively engaged. And if the audience's imagination is actively engaged, then they're automatically going to bring their own lives to it, and it becomes a personal night of storytelling for each person who walks through that door.
Well, can you give us just a little bit of one of Jingle's stories from the beginning, a sense of how it gets underway?
Sure. So Dickens is starting his introduction, and he says, "For often the path we choose to walk reveals itself a steeper climb than first we expected. But I take much comfort, for all of us, in the observation that in journeys, as in life, it is a great deal easier to go downhill than up."
"Up here, Mr. Pickwick, sir. On the carriage. Now, watch your step there. Yes, thank you, but no, no, I insist. Friends too. Room for all. Up on top, gentlemen. Now, balance it out now. Is there not space enough inside the carriage? A wooden ear of it, sir. Only way to see the world, this. Only way. Sit down, gentlemen. Quick now. Archway coming. Heads, heads. Take care of your heads. Lovely way to travel, this, but dangerous. Dangerous work. Other day, 5 children, mother, tall lady, eating sandwiches, forgot the arch. Crash, knock. Children look round, mother's head, off. Sandwich in her hand, no mouth to put it in. Head of a family, off. Shocking, shocking. Contemplating that, Mr. Pickwick, sir. Eh? Contemplating that. And thus it begins.
You get grins right away on everybody's face.
Hopefully, yeah.
That's all the idea. It one of Dickens' great advantages was that he could paint pictures with words,
mm-hmm.
the scenes that he saw come across. But it's a challenge, has to be a challenge for you. You've got 2 gentlemen right there at the beginning.
Right.
Almost 3. You've got Dickens in 2 different characters. I mean, Dickens as Pickwick and Dickens as the lecturer.
Yeah, of course, doing it on the radio is one thing. It relies on inflection of voice and changing the timbre of the voice and the rhythms of the voice a little bit. And then again, the imagination of the audience then goes wild. On stage, we didn't want to change hats and put on a shawl and do that sort of thing. So it became gestural instead, so that I would come up with a single physical gesture that would get introduced right away with the character. That became a cue then for the audience that whenever I went back to that physical gesture, along with what I was doing vocally.
Dickens was back on stage, or...
Right, or, oh, that's whoever. Jingles again. Oh, you know, Mr. Pickwick always holds his ample tummy, you know, and that sort of thing. So,
yeah,
little clues for the audience.
So where did you go? What, you went through the main things that we know. Oliver Twist, mm-hmm. Great Expectations, Hard
right,
Times.
Right. He really gets to just get on a roll at first with the several selections. David Copperfield, he talks about himself as an actor, loving to be an actor. And then all of a sudden he goes into Hard Times and there's this teacher, Mr. Gradgrind. And
I wish everybody could see the grin you get on your face when you say the names.
He was the first character that I fell in love with when I was working on this piece. Just a little bit of that. I sort of physicalized him a little bit like a vulture, you know, leaning over the front of the podium. But he's
girl number 20. I don't know that girl. Who is that girl?
Sissy Jupe, sir, explained number 20, blushing.
Sissy's not a name. Don't call yourself Sissy. Call yourself Cecilia.
But my father calls me Sissy, sir.
Then he has no business to do it. Tell me mustn't, Cecilia Jupe.
And he just goes on and on. He just is such an oppressive, awful character. And then at the end of that section, Dickens says, yes, Mr. Gradgrind, a man of facts and calculations with a rule and pair of scales always in his pocket, ready to weigh and measure any parcel of human nature and tell you exactly what it's worth. Would that he were merely a fiction. A society without imagination never did, never can, never will hold a great place under the sun. Without imagination, there is no compassion. And that then became the sort of the thesis statement for our entire night. Without imagination, there is no compassion. And so then he starts reading purposefully selections that have to do with that very thesis statement. He gets, you know, because it's the last night, he gets fired up again as though he's writing a brand new book. And who are these people who have all this power to make great significant change in the lives of people who have nothing? And all they do is get fat and feed each other and maintain their power and the status quo. That's awful. You know, that is the thing that keeps lighting that fuel under him time and time again.
So give me an example, another scene from Dickens in America.
Let's see.
I remember in seeing you do this that he seemed to talk about religion.
Yes.
Quite frequently.
Yeah, well, he gets into, right away in Oliver Twist, he's talking about, Oliver Twist was in a parish orphanage. So it was run by the church and the church board. And the parish beadle, Mr. Bumble, was a central figure in that. And yet the children who were in these places were starving the very beginning of that. Although I'm not disposed to maintain that being born in a workhouse is in itself the most enviable circumstance that can befall a human being, I do mean to say that it was the best thing that could have occurred for Oliver Twist. The fact is, there was considerable difficulty in inducing the infant Oliver to take upon him the office of respiration, and for some time he lay gasping on a little flock mattress, rather unequally poised between this world and the next. Now, if during this brief period Oliver had been surrounded by anxious aunts, experienced nurses, and doctors of profound wisdom, he would most inevitably have been killed in no time. And on and on. But he gets then to Mr. Bumble and this very famous scene of Oliver asking for more. Just another little tiny bowl of the most watery thin gruel, and all chaos breaks loose. You know, these adults are offended, mortally, morally offended that one of their charges should dare to ask for more, to say that he was still hungry. And so here's a short section on Dickens getting a little fired up but not being able to stop himself. When I completed Oliver Twist, I full expected it would be objected to on some very high moral grounds in some very high moral quarters. The result did not fail to prove the justice of my anticipations. Of these self-appointed standard-bearers of a morality, let me simply say that I have no respect for their opinion, good or bad, do not covet their approval, and do not write for their amusement. These insects of the hour, who raise their little hum and beat their wings, and die forgotten. I am waxing political. Forgive me. My doctors have warned me about that. I beg pardon? As Sam Weller said, but when I gets on this here grievance, I runs on like a new barrow with a wheel just greased. And yet, I satirize them not because I and the rest of mankind are devoid of such oppressive tendencies, but because the self-indulgence and lack of compassion in public figures directly influences the lives of so many innocents, the young, the old, the infirm. I learned as a mere boy to hold suspect those whose moral and religious beliefs conveniently coincide with their earthly goals. And then there are those of so refined and delicate a nature they cannot bear to contemplate the horrors of this world, and therefore feel that no one else should contemplate them either. I have no faith in the delicacy that cannot bear to look upon the truth. I myself have known what it is to have no hope. That is no matter. There is nothing delicate about poverty, or its causes, or the horrors which it breeds. And thus he begins his rant against hypocrisy, both institutional and religious.
So who, in the end, is your favorite of these? You get to be a dozen more characters. I know Dickens. Leave Dickens himself alone for a moment.
Yeah, he's such a wonderful man that I really did fall in love with him as I worked on this. But I think my favorite character is that Mr. Gradgrind. He's just so despicable. But certainly, we picked these pieces and settled on these pieces because each one spoke to something very particular in our world today and to our experience as artists. There's one section where the young David Copperfield talks about going to a play for the first time and falling in love with this world. You know, he talks about seeing, and there I saw Julius Caesar. To have all those noble Romans alive before me and walking in and out for my entertainment. You know, so he just is taken with this world where anything is possible.
Jim Ridge is presenting his one-man show, Dickens in America, in several venues in the Midwest. Jim is a member of the core company of American Players Theater in Spring Green, Wisconsin. It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to purchase a copy of this hour, please call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for Talk the Line, number 1111B. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you'll also find a link to the weekly podcast. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. I produced this hour with Mary Lou Finnegan and help from Ann Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. We always like to know what you think of our programs. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. We look forward to hearing from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.